This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Ecuador was once seen as a peaceful haven in a turbulent region, a country with low homicide rates and a reputation for stability and beautiful nature. But over the past few years, that image has been shattered. Ecuador has become one of the most violent places in Latin America, with drug trafficking organizations and gangs carrying out assassinations, beheadings, bombings, and even large-scale prison massacres. In response, the government there has declared an internal armed conflict, a war, and deployed the military to wage a full-scale war on those gangs. Officials say the crackdown is necessary to retake control, to establish some sort of order, but human rights groups warned that these mass arrests and raids and disappearances, abuses, that they're creating a climate of fear, especially among the poorest communities. The Catholic Church has stepped in both as a mediator and as a moral voice, calling for peace and restraint, even in the face of all the drug violence. We're joined by Marcel Medicifin. He is the director of a new PBS Frontline documentary called Drug War in Ecuador. And Marcel, welcome to The Source.
Hey there. Thank you for having me.
The documentary already aired on PBS, but you can watch it on YouTube. It's also available on the Frontline channel on the PBS app. You can watch it on Frontline's PBS on their website. It's an incredible documentary. It certainly is jarring. So, Marcel, how did Ecuador, once considered one of the safest countries in Latin America, become the hub of a drug trade and become so dangerous?
Well, this is certainly something which went a little bit unseen in such a very short amount of time. I think we can pretty much date it around COVID, when basically everything was on a standstill, but the drug trafficking kind of kept on going because it was illegal. And Ecuador is placed between Colombia and Peru, and especially Colombia is the biggest drug producing country, which normally would export all the drugs to the US. But it was then when the fentanyl crisis started in the US. So the cocaine consumption kind of dropped. But after COVID, it skyrocketed in Europe. And Ecuador became the safe haven and the most strategic point to get all this drug, which was piling off in the warehouses, illegal warehouses. And so the different drug cartels very quickly realized that there is big business to do. And there is the Sinaloa cartel, there is the Jalisco Nueva Generación cartel, the Albanese mafia, the Russians and the Italians. So basically everybody is there because they realized, A, there is no DEA, there is no U.S. military base because of Rafael Correa, who had kind of kicked them out years ago. And most importantly, it's dollarized. So there, it's a very good place to immediately launder the money into U.S. dollars.
Just recently, Ecuadorians voted to reject a package of a referendum measures that would have allowed the United States to put bases back in Ecuador. So even though they have this violence and they're looking for ways to establish peace and security, they did not want to bring back the United States bases.
Well, I think it's because this was just one part of the referendum, and the referendum would have been going much further and would change the constitution to give the current government under Daniel Noboa much more freedom and to really establish sort of autocracy. And it's the people who realize that this policy of fear didn't really work. It was not as successful as he promised. He obviously, there is an absolute, not only the right, there is an obligation of a state to retake control of the streets. But here's a clear proof that fighting violence only with violence doesn't work. The source of the violence, the social inequality, the lack of opportunities, basically the vacuum of a state in large part of the country, led to this diabolic circle, which is basically inequality leads to exclusion, leads to lack of opportunities, and that all the young people see their only opportunity in joining the gangs. And this create this kind of terrible chain of consequences, which is a more brutality, more inequality, and basically all this which created this new tsunami of violence, which been unseen, and it's led to being the now most dangerous country in the world.
Yeah, so I want to highlight the point that you made earlier. So Ecuador doesn't really produce drugs. The cocaine either comes from Colombia or it comes from Peru. Ecuador is kind of like right in the middle of the two. They have a seaport in which they're able to ship a lot of the drugs into up to the west coast of the United States or into Mexico where it moves over land. So it's just become this trafficking hub. Ecuador was not really prepared to deal with all of the money and the brutality that these gangs, the Russians, Albanians, other people who were trying to take over, and they were able to outmuscle the state, the government, and create these gangs. And the gangs have become the center of so many people's lives. The young men, they're recruited or forced into the gangs. And they run free on the streets. They say that the whole social order has broken down, that life is as cheap as the cost of a bullet, they say.
Yeah, it's absolutely terrible, the situation. If you live in at the coast, the in the suburbs, which are super large, and you there's no escape. If you're a young boy, between age 6, not well, 8, 10 until 17, there is a basically there is a forced recruitment going on, and you have to join any of these rivaling gangs, or you get killed. And the problem here is, I think that there's no recipe. Once the demon is in, it's going to be very, very hard because the business is so huge. We're talking about, I think, 280 tons of cocaine being seized last year, and for each ton which gets seized in Guayaquil or in Esmeraldas, they think that 9 tons are going through for each one which gets seized. So this is a multi-billion business, and nobody really is interested. And I think once the cartels are in, it's not only cocaine, they're going into the gold business, they're going into the human trafficking business. It's just took over, like in Colombia in the 80s and 90s.
They're saying that there was the violence got so bad that there was a murder about one every hour in the country throughout the entire a year. So many murders that it was impossible to count.
Exactly. And it's when I was filming there, we just it's one of those. I'm used to work in crisis,
Yeah, you were in
and mostly
Syria, you've been in all sorts of places.
I've been basically all around in war-torn countries and conflicts. But this violence is different. It looks all normal because people are not, now got to used to it, and they're kind of doing their day-to-day things until somebody comes up on a motorbike and wants to kill somebody, and instead of only killing him, just kills 20 people. And this, so it looks normal, it looks peaceful until it's just too dangerous. And I think that was, and this happens all the time.
So how did you protect yourself? I mean, you stick out. You're a foreigner. You have camera crews. That's no guarantee of safety.
So my mother is from Ecuador, so I do speak. I'm bilingual. I speak mother tongue Spanish, which was very helpful. And I do work with a minimal crew. It's me alone with somebody who is from in Esmeraldas. I worked with somebody from Esmeraldas in Guayaquil, somebody from Guayaquil. We call them local producers, fixers, who do know how to move around. And that's how I was very low-key, trying to find the characters. And that's why I met this absolute charismatic priest who is helping both. On one hand, the victims of the gang violence. On the other hand, he's focusing very much now on the victims of the state abuses or the violence, which sometimes, or not only sometimes, are producing a lot of victims. And here he was trying to say a state, as I said, a democracy needs to restore order, but they have to not, they are not allowed to abandon the rule of law. And here is what what people in Ecuador were afraid that the new government with this referendum would try to do, and that's why they voted against it.
All right, I'm going to take a break here. When we come back, I want to find out more about this priest who is so amazing in your documentary on Frontline. Which is available on YouTube and on the PBS app. It's called Drug War in Ecuador. Incredible violence. The breakdown of social order, it just has to be seen to be believed. You can call in with your questions and comments at 833-877-8255. The Source continues after a one-minute break. Stay with us.
Support for the Source podcast comes from UT Health San Antonio, South Texas' largest academic research institution, where what is discovered in its labs translates into life-changing patient care. More at uthealthsa.org.
Have a property past its prime? Consider donating it to Texas Public Radio. It's hassle-free, and you may qualify for a tax write-off, too. Learn more at tpr.careasy.org/realestatedonation.
You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. We're speaking with Marcel Messelfessen. He is the director of a PBS Frontline documentary called Drug War in Ecuador. It's available for viewing on YouTube and on the Frontline channel and on the PBS app they have. And so the Catholic Church has become the only state if structure that really seems to be functioning, providing some guidance, brokering peace between gangs. Marcel, so how is the Catholic Church able to do this?
I think the Catholic Church always played a big role in Latin America. I think it's here in Ecuador, it's always some individuals, priests, who dedicated their entire life to the poor. Padre José Antonio Maeso is a Spanish priest, interestingly, who I would kind of describe him as one of those reminding figures of La Teología de la Liberación, the left-wing church who romanticized
liberation theology that we had before.
Sorry, exactly. Liberation theology, who always been fighting for the poor. He's there in Ecuador and Esmeralda since 25 years, working with this impoverished, mostly Afro-Ecuadorian neighborhoods and communities. And he is trying to give them help to organize microfinance and programs and just be there. In parts where you can basically say that a state never really existed, and now when I came to Ecuador a year ago, and wanted to do something about the current situation and trying to explain what happened to this once so peaceful country, I was afraid, a little bit worried that I would do the very typical form: once peaceful, now cartels comes in, and you would see all this, the gang members telling how they brutally kill others. And so I was looking for an interesting character, and that's when I found him. To see just the next kind of part of a story, how it goes, because I think here it's the interesting part which makes this so universal, and it's not only about Ecuador. We're talking here about a state which went completely out of control, got out of control, and the new government is trying to restore order. But you have these communities and you have these young people who are joining the gangs, who are now a new level of toxicity came in, which is social media. This is the TikTok, this is the Instagram, the Telegram generation, which does see that they 24/7 that they are poor. Poverty and inequality always existed in Ecuador, in Latin America, all around the world, but it's now this new element that these young people, they do feel that they don't have a chance, that they were, the lack of opportunity never gonna make them fulfill the dreams they see day in and day out, the glittery world of the Instagrammers living the wealth in Dubai or anywhere else. And this creates anger. This creates frustration and indignation. And it does creates it everywhere. I mean, that's why the huge radicalization, the polarization, the division of our society goes on. And if it's happening in the Western world, in a country like where I live, in Germany or in the US or everywhere, it obviously happens as well in a country like Ecuador, where people are armed as well. And this is a social experiment, which is a ticking time bomb. And there you can see how it goes wrong. Those kids just take their arms and they say, okay, I just want to have the iPhone. I just want to make the very quick dime. And we've worshipped the narco culture and we've seen it on Netflix and we've seen what we have to do. And that told me this into my camera, that everything they did, how they dismantle the people they kill, they have learned on TV. And that's because they want to have this lifestyle they think is important in order to be something in their community. And that's what, for me, was the most shocking thing to experience.
Drug use in the United States is the reason why a lot of this violence is happening. So people who use cocaine, purchase cocaine here in the U.S., shouldn't they have some awareness that they are responsible for what's going on in Ecuador?
Well, I think this is the most... I don't really understand why everybody is aware of speaking politically correct, not eating meat, be vegan, in order to, if you have a conscience about your own action, but it never really applied on the drug consumption. The only reason why not to take cocaine is not your health, it's political reason, because you have to understand that every gram of cocaine is filled with blood, with a lot of blood, not from only from Ecuador, but all around the world, because wars are being fought because of drug trafficking. So the only solution actually would be perhaps to legalize or to find a way to take out this huge, enormous business out of the whole equation, let people understand that the taking drugs means that you're part and guilty of all the tragedies happening in Latin America.
The police or the government has taken on this extreme brutal countermeasure to try to rein in the cartels, but they basically have become a gang themselves. It's sort of like the cure is just as bad or worse than the disease, or we have to burn down this village in order to save it mentality. But they're dealing with such brutal tactics to begin with. How can they not adopt such harsh measures in response?
And this is the huge conundrum, how to solve this. And my other storyline in the film is a grieving family, a grieving father, Ronnie, who lost his 11-year-old son, who's been besieged by four kids, boys between 11 and 14, last December, have been abducted by the police and the military in a raid, and they never been seen again. And they 30 days later, they found them beheaded, burned, tortured, dead in a swamp. And here you see one example of one of the most tragic, terrible, horrific examples of state violence, which are consequences if you send the soldiers on the street in order to fight.
They're trying to fight the gangs, but they're not trained police officers. They're a blunt instrument, and they swept up anyone who got in their way and killed them brutally.
And killed them. And you have this Human Rights Watch, Amnesty International, even the State Department, the current State Department, launched a report about the human rights allegations against the current government, saying that they are trespassing a lot of rule of law, which is terrible right now. And that's what the film is about.
So what's the structural conditions, the inequality, corruption, youth unemployment? I mean, what would need to change in order to reduce the violence, to bring some stability and hope to the region?
I think the institutions first and foremost needs to be restored. If you have money, you never will be have to go to court. Impunity is one of the biggest reasons why violence is getting out of control. And I think you need to rebuild the institutions of this country first. Have a country and a government who provides for the people opportunities, and then work on the social fabric. The country is very, very divided. Obviously, there's a lot of people who are tremendously afraid. Having seen a country which used to be so peaceful suddenly becoming the most dangerous country in the world. And a lot of people are asking the government to be hard. In Spanish, you say la mano dura, the hard fist approach against these gangs in order to restore peace. But you see it on the numbers. All this hard fist approach did not work out. The numbers are still going up. And there you see, is it either because the policy of fear actually needs this fear on a high level in order to pre-exist, or is just the approach the wrong one? And I think time will just show how it works. Everybody is saying the example, El Salvador and Bukele, is the one which works. It was so much more complicated. Ecuador is so much more complicated. It's bigger, and it's much more complicated to control. And that's why I don't think it's the right thing to compare, to say, do it like Bukele, and then you have the thing under control.
Well, people need to understand what's happening there. And your documentary, Drug War in Ecuador, the PBS Frontline, really helps people get a better idea. It steps away from some of the simplistic reporting I've seen elsewhere. So Marcel Masalfisson, thank you so much for doing a documentary and coming on and telling us about it today. I appreciate that.
Thank you so much for having me.
And it is available to view on YouTube. That's The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Thanks for listening.
This has been The Source on Texas Public Radio. The Source is hosted by David Martin Davies. Tim Gutierrez is the show's producer. Additional production support from Steve Short, Ruben Garcia, Yvette Benavides, and Dan Katz, Vice President of News. The Source is made possible with support from the Gladys and Ralph Lazarus Foundation. Support for this podcast of The Source comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' compensation provider committed to rewarding policyholders who keep their workers safe and losses low. More at texasmutual.com/TXM Advantage. Texas Mutual. Texans get it.